readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and wow, this summer has been a sizzler. But I'm happy to report there has been an array of titles sizzling at the top of the bestseller list. This week, we'll look at the blockbusters written by the ladies, the mysteries, the adventure, and yes, the romance, titles for every taste. So guys, you stay put. And we'll be speaking with Lisa C., whose most recent book, Dreams of Joy, debuted at the top of the New York Times bestseller list. We'll hear about her new movie, too. So relax, grab a long, cool drink, and let's look at books that are hot right now.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MAGICBUZ.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
In her beloved New York Times bestsellers, Snowflower and the Secret Fan, Peony in Love, and most recently, Shanghai Girls, author Lisa C. illuminates the bonds of mother love, romantic love, and love of country. Now, in Dreams of Joy, she returns to these timeless themes, continuing the story of sisters Pearl and May from Shanghai Girls, but adding in the tale of Pearl's strong-willed 19-year-old daughter, Joy. The author was born in Paris but grew up in Los Angeles. She spent a great deal of time with her father's family in Chinatown. Her first book, On Gold Mountain, The 100-Year Odyssey of My Chinese-American Family, traces the journey of her great-grandfather, Fong Xi, who overcame obstacles at every step to become the 100-year-old godfather of Los Angeles's Chinatown and the patriarch of a sprawling family. While collecting the details for On Gold Mountain, Lisa developed the idea for her first novel, Flower Net, in 1997, followed by two more mystery thrillers, The Interior and Dragon Bones. Lisa has always been intrigued by stories that have been lost, forgotten, or deliberately covered up. Peony in Love takes place in 17th century China in the Yangtze River Delta. It's based on the true story of three lovesick maidens who were married to the same man, one right after the other, not one reaching the age of 20. Together, these young women wrote the first book of its kind published anywhere in the world by women. For her Snowflower, Lisa traveled to a remote area of China where she was told she was only the second foreigner ever to visit. While there, she researched the secret writing invented, used, and kept a secret by women for over 1,000 years. The movie, just out this July, was actually co-produced by Wendy Deng, the wife of Rupert Murdoch, with her great friend Florence Sloan. In addition to writing books, Lisa was the Publisher Weekly's West Coast correspondent for 13 years, a freelance journalist, and she curated the inaugural exhibition of the Chinese American Museum in Los Angeles. Welcome, Lisa. Thanks for taking the time from your very busy book tour to visit with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dreams of Joy debuted at number one on the New York Times bestseller list, and it was selected as Amazon's Book of the Month. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. You know, that number one on the New York Times list, that is something I never wished for or hoped for. I just never thought that that was something that could happen to me. So I have just been so just unbelievably happy. I just can't believe it.
Well, it's a great story. So Dreams of Joy continues the story of May and Pearl from your immensely popular Shanghai Girls. What made you pick up their story at this juncture in their lives? And can you give us a sneak peek of the story?
Yeah, so Dreams of Joy does pick up right where Shanghai Girls left off, where the daughter, Joy, has just found out that the woman she thought was her mother is not her mother, the man that she thought was her father is not her father, and all of these revelations which cause her in this sort of fit of despair and sadness and guilt and grief and actually a little anger to run away to the People's Republic of China. And then her birth mother, Pearl, comes after her looking for her. And while it is a sequel, there's a 3-page part right at the very beginning of the book that kind of catches you up if you haven't read the previous book. And if you did read the previous book 2 years ago and are a little hazy on the details, that 3 pages will catch you up as well.
Okay. Do you actually visit China each time to do research each time before you write a book, or how do you do that?
Of course, I go to China for every book, and with this one, I wanted part of it to take place in Shanghai, but also out in the countryside in a small village. And so I traveled to this very small village in Anhui province that once had been a pretty wealthy village. I stayed in what they called a villa. It was the big villa, the big house in the village of about 300 people. But, a villa in China is not the same as a villa in Tuscany.
Yeah.
So it was pretty remote and pretty far out there. But I was able to visit with people who had lived through the time period that I'm writing about. It's a great leap forward when it was a pretty terrible time in China. And so to get people to talk about that and what their families went through, and then also just to see how people are living their daily lives even today. You know, we think of China as being this big, modern country, it's a global economic superpower. But when you go out into the countryside, into these small villages, it's like you're stepping back in time 100, 200, 300 years. And so I get to see how people make baskets and how they grow their food and how they cook and how they take care of their babies. And it's just so different than being in a city, first of all. And then, of course, so different than being here in the United States.
Mm. Are your books published in Chinese? And actually, do you do book tours there?
My books are all published in China. I haven't gone on official book tour to China, but I have done some events there, and I've also done a lot of interviews there. And then also this summer, a film of Snowflower and the Secret Fan is going to come out simultaneously in the United States and in China. And so for that, I've actually been doing quite a bit of interviews and things like that in China. And to me, it's so interesting because there are a lot of things there that they don't know about, you know, that people grew up not knowing about. So, for example, now with Dreams of Joy, I am getting asked a lot of questions about the Great Leap Forward. We know more about it here than they know about it there, young people. So there, the journalists will ask me things like, you know, why did you choose to write about the 3 years of bad weather? Because that's how they learned about this famine and about this whole big campaign, was that it was really just 3 years of bad weather, and that, you know, I don't know that 45 million people died or all of the different campaigns that went into the Great Leap Forward.
Ah, well, actually, I wanted to ask you about the movie. Were you involved in the production at all?
I saw every single version of the script, and I would write them very long emails. They were all in China filming, and I was actually on book tour for Shanghai Girls, so I couldn't go. But I would write them these long, long emails, and sometimes we'd have conference calls. I would say that they listened to some of what I had to say and some of my suggestions, and some things they didn't listen to at all. The film, the part that is true to the book is absolutely true to the book. I mean, it's just exactly like the book. But they also have created a modern story that wraps sort of in and around the original story. And that is a story of friendship that takes place right now today in Shanghai. So it's, you know, this parallel story of friendship, one that takes place in the past and one that takes place today.
Ah, so does that mean you didn't actually get to meet Hugh Jackman?
I haven't gotten to meet him yet. I'm hoping one of the premieres, there are three different premieres, and I'm hoping that I get to meet him at one of them.
Well, I'd love to, too.
I mean, I'd better.
Yeah,
I really want to.
Yeah. In preparing for this interview, I learned about Angel Island, and I think most Americans really have no idea. Can you tell us about the experiences that your family had there and how you used them in your writing?
Right. Well, so Angel Island is considered the Ellis Island of the West Coast. It sits in San Francisco Bay, and all of the Chinese immigrants in the past used to go through Angel Island. And Angel Island had opened very specifically to keep the Chinese out. This was an outgrowth of the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, which had barred the immigration of all Chinese immigrants to the United States, except for those who fell into four categories: a merchant, a diplomat, a student, or a minister. So they, you know, they were really looking for those people. And while it's true that there were people from, I think it's 138 countries who passed through Angel Island, really, again, it was to really open just to keep the Chinese out. So my family, I have a lot of relatives who came through Angel Island. My great-grandfather was one of the legitimate categories of people who could come and go, and that was a merchant. And so every time he would leave the country, every time he would come back, he was interrogated. But it wasn't just him. They would go and they would interview the policeman on the beat, the man who did hauling, the tombstone maker on the corner, his wife, his children, his employees, to make sure that he was the person he said he was. And so this happened with every immigrant. Now, again, my great-grandfather, he was a legitimate merchant, and other people in our family, some of them were legitimate merchants, and some of them were merchants only on paper, in the sense that my great-grandfather had his own business, he had no partners, but he would keep this list of people that were to pay him to be his partners, so anywhere from $50 to $500, so that they would be allowed to come in.
So
one of the things that happened, I think, for a lot of families were paper sons, people who had come in illegally masquerading as the sons of American citizens. And those people, you know, is who the immigration officers were looking for most of all. And so people like my great-grandfather, they would pass through Angel Island in 2, 3, 4 days. But for most immigrants, Chinese immigrants, they would be interrogated and questioned for weeks, months, sometimes up to 2 years, at which point they would be deported back to China, be allowed to land, or maybe commit suicide.
Oh, well, your early books were mystery thrillers, then came On Gold Mountain, the history of your family, and then now these books on the bonds of women. What's next? Are you going to continue with the women-centric books, or what are your next projects?
I've already begun doing research on the next book, and this has to do with something called the Chop Suey Circuit. This was a string of nightclubs that were in New York, San Francisco, Chicago, but a lot of them just all around the country during the 1930s and 40s, where they were kind of like the Cotton Club in the sense that these were all Asian performers, but the audience was mostly Caucasian. And the performers, they billed themselves as things like, you know, the Chinese Frank Sinatra, the Chinese Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, the Chinese Sophie Tucker. And so I have been interviewing people who were in the Chop Suey Circuit or their sons and daughters. I've also have been looking at archival material, people's old costumes and headdresses and shoes and all of their old scrapbooks from those days. And this was a very interesting time period because during World War II, China and the United States were allies. And so all of these bad feelings that had been targeted towards Chinese immigrants prior to the war had evaporated. And for this very short period, China and the United States were allies. And then, of course, in 1949, that was all over when Mao took over China. And so this kind of sense of renewal and opportunity for performers, people who had never had a chance ordinarily in traditional show business, now were able to go into it.
Thank you so much, and I wish you continued success on your book tour.
Great. Thank you so much.
In Dreams of Joy, daughter Joy uncovers family secrets that cause her to run away to Shanghai in early 1957 to find her birth father, an artist with whom both sisters, May and Pearl, had once been in love. Dazzled by him and blinded by idealism and defiance, Joy throws herself into the new society of Red China, heedless of the dangers in the communist regime and the Great Leap Forward. Devastated by Joy's flight and terrified for her safety, Pearl is determined to save her daughter, no matter the personal cost. From the crowded city to remote villages, Pearl confronts old demons and insurmountable challenges as she follows Joy, hoping for reconciliation. Yet even as Joy and Pearl's separate journeys converge, one of the most tragic episodes in China's history threatens their lives. In reading the reader reviews, which are all strong, you should probably read Shanghai Girls first to get the most out of this title. This book is read by Janet Song.
The wail of a police siren in the distance tears through my body. Crickets whir in a never-ending chorus of blame. My aunt whimpers in her twin bed at the other end of the screened porch we share, a reminder of the misery and embarrassment from the secrets she and my mother threw at each other during their argument tonight. I try to listen for my mother in her room, but she's too far away. That silence is painful. My hands grab the bedsheets, and I struggle to focus on an old crack in the ceiling. I'm desperately attempting to hang on, but I've been on a precipice since my father's death, and now I feel as though I've been pushed over the edge and I'm falling. Everything I thought I knew about my birth, my parents, my grandparents, and who I am has been a lie. A big, fat lie. The woman I thought was my mother is my aunt. My aunt is actually my mother. The man I loved as my father was not related to me at all. My real father is an artist in Shanghai, whom both my mother and aunt have loved since before I was born. And that's only the tip of the iceberg, as Auntie May might say. But I was born in the year of the tiger, so before the gnawing blackness of guilt about my dad's death and the anguish I feel about these revelations overpower me, I grip the sheets tighter, set my jaw, and try to force my emotions to cower and shrink before my tiger ferocity. It doesn't work. I wish I could talk to my friend Hazel, but it's the middle of the night. I wish even more that I could be back at the University of Chicago, because my boyfriend Joe would understand what I'm going through. I know he would. It's 2 a.m. by the time my aunt drifts off to sleep, and the house seems quiet. I get up and go to the hall, where my clothes are kept in a linen closet. Now I can hear my mother weeping, and it's heartbreaking. She can't imagine what I'm about to do, but even if she did, would she stop me? I'm not her daughter. Why should she stop me? I quickly pack a bag. I'll need money for where I'm going, and the only place I know to get it will bring me more disgrace and shame. I hurry to the kitchen, look under the sink, and pull out the coffee can that holds my mother's savings to put me through college. This money represents all her hopes and dreams for me, but I'm not that person anymore. She's always been cautious, and for once, I'm grateful. Her fear of banks and Americans will fund my escape. I look for paper and a pencil, sit down at the kitchen table, and scrawl a note. Mom, I don't know who I am anymore. I don't understand this country anymore. I hate that it killed Dad. I know you'll think I'm confused and foolish. Maybe I am, but I have to find answers. Maybe China is my real home. I go on to write that I mean to find my real father and that she shouldn't worry about me. I fold the paper and take it to the porch. Auntie May doesn't stir when I put the note on my pillow. At the front door, I hesitate. My invalid uncle is in his bedroom at the back of the house. He's never done anything to me. I should tell him goodbye, but I know what he'll say. Communists are no good. They'll kill you. I don't need to hear that, and I don't want him to alert my mother and aunt that I'm leaving. I pick up my suitcase and step into the night. At the corner, I turn down Alpine Street and head for Union Station. It's August 23rd, 1957, and I want to memorize everything because I doubt I'll ever see Los Angeles Chinatown again. I used to love to stroll these streets, and I know them better than any place else in the world. Here, I know everyone, and everyone knows me. The houses, almost all of them clapboard bungalows, have been what I call Chinafied, with bamboo planted in the gardens, pots with miniature kumquat trees sitting on porches, and wooden planks laid on the ground on which to spread leftover rice for birds. I look at it all differently now. 9 months at college, and the events of tonight will do that.
Patchett's State of Wonder is a provocative and ambitious novel set deep in the Amazon jungle. Research scientist Dr. Marina Singh is sent to Brazil to track down her former mentor, Dr. Anik Svensson, who seems to have disappeared in the Amazon while working on an extremely valuable new drug. The last person sent to find her died before he could complete his mission. Plagued by trepidation, Marina embarks on an odyssey into the insect-infested jungle in hopes of finding answers to the questions about her friend's death, her company's future, and her own past. Once found, Dr. Svensson is as uncompromising as ever. But while she is as threatening as anything the jungle has to offer, the greatest sacrifices made are the ones Dr. Svensson asks of herself and will ultimately ask of Marina. State of Wonder, brilliantly read by Hope Davis, is a tale that leads listeners into the heart of darkness and shows them what lies on the other side.
I cannot call it a canoe. There never were statistics written to cover the probability of its arrival. But still, it was in a country. It was in the world. Surely someone down there had an internet connection. Had they never bothered to find it? Wouldn't she call you? There has to be some sort of global satellite.
She won't use the phone, or she says it doesn't work there.
As close as they were in this quiet room, she could scarcely hear his voice.
But for this... She stopped herself. He didn't know.
Where is he now? Marina asked. She could not bring herself to say his body. Anders was not a body. Vogel was full of doctors, doctors working, doctors in their offices drinking coffee. The cabinets and storage rooms and desk drawers were full of drugs, pills of every conceivable stripe. They were a pharmaceutical company. What they didn't have, they figured out how to make. Surely, if they knew where he was, they could find something to do for him. And with that thought, her desire for the impossible eclipsed every piece of science she had ever known. The dead were dead, were dead. Were dead. And still, Marina Singh did not have to shut her eyes to see Anders Ekman eating an egg salad sandwich in the employee cafeteria, as he had done with great enthusiasm every day she had known him. "Don't you read the reports on cholesterol?" she would ask, always willing to play the straight man. "I write the reports on cholesterol," Anders said, running his finger around the edge of his plate. Mr. Fox lifted his glasses. pressed his folded handkerchief against the corners of his eyes. "Read the letter," he said. She did not read it aloud. "Jim Fox, the rain has been torrential here, not unseasonable, yet year after year it never ceases to surprise me. It does not change our work, except to make it more time-consuming, and if we have been slowed, we have not been deterred. We move steadily towards the same excellent results. But for now, this business is not our primary concern. I write with unfortunate news of Dr. Ekman, who died of a fever 2 nights ago. Given our location, this rain, the petty bureaucracies of government, both this one and your own, and the time-sensitive nature of our project, we chose to bury him here, in a manner in keeping with his Christian traditions. I must tell you, it was no small task. As for the purpose of Dr. Ekman's mission, I assure you we are making strides. I will keep what little he had here for his wife, to whom I trust you will extend this news along with my sympathy. Despite any setbacks, we persevere. Anik Swenson." Morena started over at the top. When she had read through it again, she still could not imagine what to say. Is she calling Anders a setback? She held the letter by its slightest edges, as if it were a document still to be submitted into evidence. Clearly, the paper had been wet at some point and then dried again. She could tell by the way it was puckered in places. It had been carried out in the rain. Dr. Swenson knew all about the relationship of paper and ink and rain, and so she cut in her letters with a pencil of hard, dark lead. While on the other side of Eden Prairie, Minnesota, Karen Ekman sat in a 2-story brick colonial, thinking her husband was in Brazil and would be coming home as soon as he could make Dr. Swenson listen to reason. Morena looked at the clock. They should go soon, before it was time for Karen to pick the children up from school. Every now and then, if Anders happened to look at his watch at 2:30, he would say to himself in a quiet voice, "School's out." 3 little Ekmans, 3 boys who, like their mother, did not know enough to picture their father dead. For all that loss, Dr. Swenson had managed to use just over half the sheet of paper, and in the half a sheet she used, she had twice thought to mention the weather. The rest of it simply sat there, a great blue sea of emptiness. How much could have been said in those remaining inches, how much explained, was beyond scientific measure.
Adopted by a pair of diehard hippies, restless, marginal Jude Keffie Horn spends much of his youth getting high with his best friend Teddy in their Vermont hometown. But when Teddy dies of an overdose, Jude's relationship with drugs and with his parents devolves to new extremes. Sent to live with his pot-dealing father in New York's East Village, Jude stumbles upon Straight Edge, an underground youth culture powered by the paradoxical aggression of hardcore punk and a righteous intolerance of drugs, meat, and sex. Moving back and forth between Vermont and New York City, 10,000 Saints by Eleanor Henderson is the story of a frayed tangle of family brought painfully together by a death, then carried along in anticipation of a new and unexpected life. It is the tale of teenagers battling to discover themselves, while their parents struggle with a radical reinterpretation of sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and of their awareness of nature and nurture, brotherhood and loss. Stephen Kaplan narrates.
Jude could see the dirty heels of her tennis shoes, but not much else. He reached up, the frozen fingers through his fingerless gloves inches away from her foot, but instead of enclosing them around the delicate bones of her ankle, he lifted the yellow umbrella at her feet. He slid it without a sound across the concrete and down into his arms. "What are you doing?" whispered Teddy, suddenly at Jude's elbow. "Why are we stealing an umbrella?" Jude sprung it open and looked it over. "It's not the umbrella we're stealing," he whispered back, closing it. Walking into the shadows a few rows back, he held it over his head, curved handle up like a hook. In the bleachers above, there were purses between feet, saving seats, unguarded, alone, and inside, wallets fat with cash. Teddy and Jude had no money, and no pot, and since this morning, nothing to smoke it out of but an empty can of orange slice. Last night, they'd shared a jug of Carlo Rossi and the pot they'd found in the glove box of Teddy's mom's car while they listened to Metallica's first album, Kill 'Em All, which skipped, and to Teddy's mom, Queen Bee, who had her own stash of booze, getting sick in the bathroom, wretch, flush, wretch, flush. Around midnight, they'd taken what was left of the pot and skated to Jude's to get some sleep, but in their daze had left Jude's bong behind. When they returned to Teddy's in the morning, this was the rhythm of their days, three rights and a left to Teddy's, a right and three lefts to Jude's. The bong, the color-changing Pyrex bong Jude's mother had given Jude that morning as an early birthday gift, was gone. So were Queen Bee's clothes, her car, her toothbrush, her sheets. Jude and Teddy wandered the house, flipping switches. The lights didn't work. Nothing hummed or blinked. The house was frozen with an unnatural stillness. Jude, shivering, found a candle and lit it. When Teddy opened the liquor cabinet, it was also empty. This was the final irrefutable clue. Except for a bottle of liquid plumber and a film of dust in which Teddy wrote with a finger. Beatrice McNicholas had run away a few times before. She'd go out for a six-pack and come home a week later, with a new haircut and old promises. She was no nester or nurturer. She was Queen Bee for her royal size. But she'd never taken her liquor with her, or anything of Teddy and Jude's. The boys had stolen enough from her over the years to call it even. $5 bills, maybe tens, that Queen Bee would be too drunk to miss in the morning. Liquor, cigarettes. She was the kind of unsystematic drunk whose hiding places changed routinely but remained routinely unimaginative. 10 minutes of hunting through closets and drawers, she cleaned other people's houses, but her own was a sty, could almost always turn up something. Pot was more difficult to find at Jude's house. His mom's hippie habits were somewhat reformed, and though she condoned Jude's experimentation, an appreciation for a good bong was just about all Harriet and Jude had in common. Occasional flashes of parental guilt drove her to hide her contraband in snug and impenetrable places that recalled Russian nesting dolls. In Harriet's studio, Jude had once found a Ziploc of pot inside a bag of Ricola cough drops, inside a jumbo box of tampons, inside a toolbox. While Queen Bee seemed only mildly aware that teenagers lived in her midst, sweeping them off her porch like stray cats, Harriet had a sharp eye, a peripheral third lens in her bifocals that was always ready to probe the threat of fast-fingered boys. So Jude and Teddy stole what was around. A roll of quarters from her dresser, the box of chocolates Jude's sister, Prudence, had given her for Mother's Day. They took more pleasure in what they stole out in the world. Magazines and beer from ShopSmart, ShopFart, video game cartridges from Sears, Queers, and cassettes from the record room where Cram O'Connor and Clarence Delph worked. And half the items in Jude's possession, clothes, records, homework, were stolen, without discretion, from Teddy. But this bold-faced thievery beneath the bleachers embarrassed Teddy. It was so obvious, so doomed to failure. Sometimes Teddy thought that was the prize Jude wanted. Not the money or the beer or the cigarettes, but the confrontation. The pleasure of testing the limits. Jude was standing on tiptoe, umbrella still raised like a torch, eyeing the spilled contents of a lady's bag. His tongue, molluscan and veined with blue, was wedged in concentration in the cleft under his nose. "Hey," said someone. Teddy tried to stand very still. A pair of eyes, upside down, was framed between the seats above them. It took Teddy a few seconds to grasp their orientation. The girl was leaning over, her head draped over the ledge. "What are you doing?" she said. Jude smiled up at her. "You drop your umbrella."
A book about survival, 22 Britannia Road by Amanda Hodgkinson, is one of Amazon's editor's picks of 2011. It's set in the post-World War II timeframe and chronicles people trying to put their lives back together. "Housekeeper or housewife?" the soldier asks Silvana as she and 8-year-old Arik board the ship that will take them from Poland to England at war's end. "Survivor," she answers. Her husband, Janice, is waiting for them at the little house at 22 Britannia Road. But the war has changed them all so utterly that they'll barely recognize one another when they are reunited. Silvana and Arik spent the war hiding in the forests of Poland. Janusz is an Englishman now, determined to forget Poland, forget his own ghosts, and begin a new life as a proper English family. But for Silvana, who cannot escape the painful memories of war, forgetting is not a possibility. Robin Sachs narrates.
The dead have need of fairy tales, too. Zbigniew Herbert. Spring, 1946. To England. The boy was everything to her. Small and unruly, he had a nervy way about him like a wild creature caught in the open. All the dark hearts of the lost, the found, and the never forgotten lived in his child's body, in his quick eyes. She loved him with the same unforgiving force that pushes forests from the deep ground, but still she feared it was not enough to keep him. So she was taking him to England, determined that Janusz would love him and keep him safe. On the ship's sailing list, she was named as Silvana Novak, 27 years old, married, mother of a son, Orek Josef, aged 7 years. "What is your profession?" the British soldier asked her, checking the identity papers she put before him. She looked at the documents on his desk and saw pages of women's names. All were listed as housewives or housekeepers. Behind her, hundreds more women, dressed as she was in donated clothes, stood silently with their children. Above the soldier's head, a sign in several languages, including Polish, detailed the ship's rules. All blankets and sheets remain the property of the ship. All stolen items will be confiscated. Silvana tightened her grasp on her son. The soldier glanced at her quickly and then looked back to his papers. She knew why. It embarrassed him to see a woman so unkempt and a child with such restless ways. She touched her headscarf, checking it was in place, and pressed her other hand into Oryk's back, trying to make him stand up straight. "Profession?"
"Survivor," she whispered. The first word that came to her.
The soldier didn't look up. He lifted his pen. "Housekeeper or housewife?"
"I don't know," she said,
and then aware of the queue shifting impatiently behind her.
"Housewife."
So that was it. She was recorded, written neatly into a book in indelible black ink. She was given a transport number, a label pinned on her lapel that corresponded with the details on the ship's passenger list. Proof that she and the boy were mother and son. That was a good start. Nobody, after all, could disagree with or dispute an official document. Only the title housewife looked questionable. Together or separate, Silvana was sure nobody would believe the words house or wife had anything to do with her. All night, while the sea carried the ship and its passengers toward another land, Silvana worked at remembering. She found herself a space in one of the crowded corridors below decks and sat, arms crossed, legs tucked under her. Curled into herself in this way, with Orek hidden under her coat, she breathed through the odor of sweat and diesel, the throb of the engines marking time, while she tried to recall her life with Janusz. Always, though, the same memories came to her, the ones she didn't want to own. A road she didn't want to travel, a filthy sky full of rain and planes coming out of the clouds. She shook her head, tried to think of other things, to cut off the image that would surely come. And then there it was, the wet mud shining underfoot, trees twisting in the wind, and the child swaddled in a jumble of blankets, lying in a wooden handcart. Silvana pulled Orek tighter to her, rocking him back and forth, the memories departing. He snaked a bony hand out from under her coat, and she felt his small fingers searching her face. And how was it that love and loss were so close together? Because no matter how she loved the boy, and she did, furiously, as if her own life depended on him,
Loss was always there, following at her heels.
In Silver Girl by Ellen Hildebrand, that's no relation to Laura Hildebrand, Meredith Martin Dillon has lost just about everything, her friends, her homes, and her social standing. Her husband had been caught cheating investors out of billions. Desperate, Meredith receives a call from her old friend Constance. Connie's had recent worries of her own, and the two depart for a summer on Nantucket in an attempt to put their lives back together. But the island can't offer a complete escape. They're plagued by troubles new and old. When Connie's brother Toby, Meredith's high school boyfriend, arrives, Meredith must reconcile the differences between the life she is leading and the life she could have had. Set against the backdrop of a Nantucket summer, Ellen Hildebrand delivers a suspenseful story of the power of friendship, the pull of love, and the beauty of forgiveness. The title is read by Janet Metzger and Marianne Fraulo.
Oh, Meredith, what have I done? Why are you here? I wanted a quiet summer. I wanted peace. And now I have you, a stinky international scandal in my front seat. Meredith decided to give Connie the benefit of the doubt. Oh, Meredith was a quasi-sympathetic non-answer. Connie was pulling up to the gatehouse and showing the attendant her ferry ticket. She was distracted. Meredith wore her Sun Carver's baseball hat from Choate and her last remaining pair of prescription sunglasses, which fortunately were big, round, and very dark. Meredith turned her face away from the attendant. She couldn't let anyone recognize her. Connie pulled up the ramp into the ferry's hold. Cars were packed like matchbox models in a snug little suitcase. It was the 1st of July. Even at this early hour, the mood on the boat was festive. Jeeps were laden with beach towels and hibachi grills. The car parked in front of Connie's was a vintage Wagoneer with at least 16 beach stickers in every color of the rainbow lining the bumper. Meredith's heart was bruised, battered, and broken. She told herself not to think about the boys, but all that led to was her thinking about the boys. She remembered how she used to load up the Range Rover with bags of their bathing suits and surf shirts and flip-flops, and their baseball gloves and cleats, the aluminum case that held the badminton set, fresh decks of cards, and packs of D batteries for the flashlights. Meredith would load the dog into his crate and strap Carver's surfboard to the top of the car, and off they'd go, bravely into the traffic jam that lasted from Freeport all the way to Southampton. Inevitably, they timed it badly and got stuck behind the jitney. But it had been fun. The boys took turns with the radio. Leo liked folk rock, the Counting Crows were his favorite, and Carver liked the headbanger stuff that would make the dog howl. And Meredith always felt that the hotter and slower the drive was, the happier they were to arrive in Southampton. Sun, sand, ocean. Take your shoes off, open the windows. Freddie did the drive on the weekends, and in later years he arrived in a helicopter. As Meredith looked on the summer revelers now, she thought, Leo, Carver, Leo, poor Leo. For all of the years of their growing up, Leo had taken care of Carver, protected him, schooled him, included him. And now, Carver was the one who would be supporting Leo, propping him up. Meredith prayed he was doing a good job. A voice came over the loudspeaker, announcing the rules and regulations of the boat. The foghorn sounded, and Meredith heard distant clapping. The good, fortunate souls headed to Nantucket Island on this fine morning were applauding the start of their summer. Meanwhile, Meredith felt like she was still three states away. At that very moment, federal marshals would be entering Meredith's penthouse apartment on Park Avenue and seizing her belongings. Meredith wondered with a curious detachment what this seizing would be like. To go with Connie, Meredith had packed one duffel bag of simple summer clothes and one cardboard box of personal effects. Photographs, her marriage license, the boys' birth certificates, a few of her favorite paperback novels, one particular spiral-bound notebook from her freshman year at Princeton, and one record album the original 1970 release of Simon and Garfunkel's Bridge Over Troubled Water, which Meredith had no hope of ever listening to, but which she couldn't bring herself to leave behind. She'd been permitted to take her eyeglasses, her prescription sunglasses, and her 4-carat diamond engagement ring. The ring had been inherited from her grandmother, Annabeth Martin, and not bought with dirty money. There was a strand of pearls from Meredith's mother, a present on Meredith's graduation from Princeton, which fell into the same category. But Meredith had no use for pearls now. She couldn't wear pearls in jail. With a little forethought, she might have pawned them and added the money to the paltry sum she had left. But what of her other possessions? Meredith imagined grim, strapping men in black uniforms with handguns concealed in their waistbands.
Karen Slaughter is a best-selling author, but I admit I was not previously familiar with her work. Her book, Fallen, is getting a fair amount of attention just now. There's no police training stronger than a cop's instinct. Faith Mitchell's mother isn't answering her phone. Her front door is open. There's a bloodstain above the knob. All that the Georgia Bureau of Investigations taught Faith Mitchell goes out the window when she charges into her mother's house, gun drawn. She sees a man dead in the laundry room. She sees a hostage situation in the bedroom. What she doesn't see is her mother. When the hostage situation turns deadly, Faith is left with too many questions and not enough answers. To find her mother, she'll need the help of her partner, Will Trent, and they'll both need the help of trauma doctor Sarah Linton. But Faith isn't just a cop anymore, she's a witness, and maybe even a suspect. Faith will have to go up against the people she respects to find her mother and bring the truth to light or bury it forever. Let's listen as Shannon Cochran narrates.
Her mother had a car seat identical to the one in the back of Faith's Mini. She was probably out running errands. Faith was over an hour late. Evelyn would have taken the baby and left Faith a message that she was going to be out. The woman had been on call for the majority of her adult life. She didn't go to the toilet without letting someone know. Faith and her older brother Zeke had joked about it when they were kids. They always knew where their mother was, even when they didn't want to. Especially when they didn't want to. Faith stared at the phone in her hand as if it could tell her what was going on. She was aware that she might be letting herself get worked up over nothing. The landline could be out. Her mother wouldn't know this unless she tried to make a call. Her cell phone could be switched off, or charging, or both. Her BlackBerry could be in her car, or her purse, or somewhere she couldn't hear the telltale vibration. Faith glanced back and forth between the road and her BlackBerry as she typed an email to her mother. She spoke the words aloud as she typed. On my way. Sorry I'm late. Call me. She sent the email, then tossed the phone onto the seat, along with the spilled items from her purse. After a moment's hesitation, Faith popped the gum into her mouth. She chewed as she drove, ignoring the purse lint clinging to her tongue. She turned on the radio, then snapped it back off. The traffic thinned as she got closer to the city. The clouds moved apart, sending down bright rays of sunshine. The inside of the car began to bake. 10 minutes out, Faith's nerves were still on edge, and she was sweating from the heat in the car. She cracked the sunroof to let in some air. This was probably a simple case of separation anxiety. She'd been back at work for a little over 2 months, but still, every morning when Faith left Emma at her mother's, she felt something akin to a seizure take hold. Her vision blurred, her heart shook in her chest, her head buzzed as if a million bees had flown into her ears. She was more irritable than usual at work, especially with her partner, Will Trent, who either had the patience of Job or was setting up a believable alibi for when he finally snapped and strangled her. Faith couldn't recall if she had felt this same anxiety with Jeremy, her son, who was now a freshman in college. Faith had been 18 when she entered the police academy. Jeremy was 3 years old by then. She had grabbed onto the idea of joining the force as if it were the only life preserver left on the Titanic. thanks to 2 minutes of poor judgment in the back of a movie theater and what foreshadowed a lifetime of breathtakingly bad taste in men, Faith had gone straight from puberty to motherhood without any of the usual stops in between. At 18, she had relished the idea of earning a steady paycheck so that she could move out of her parents' house and raise Jeremy the way she wanted. Going to work every day had been a step toward independence. Leaving him in daycare had seemed like a small price to pay. Now that Faith was 34, with a mortgage, a car payment, and another baby to raise on her own, she wanted nothing more than to move back into her mother's house so that Evelyn could take care of everything. She wanted to open the refrigerator and see food that she didn't have to buy. She wanted to turn on the air conditioner in the summer without worrying about having to pay the bill. She wanted to sleep until noon, then watch TV all day. Hell, while she was at it, she might as well resurrect her father, who'd died 11 years ago, so that he could make her pancakes at breakfast and tell her how pretty she was. No chance of that now. Evelyn seemed happy to play the role of nanny in her retirement, but Faith was under no illusion that her life was going to get any easier. Her own retirement was almost 20 years away. The Mini had another 3 years of payments and would be out of warranty well before that. Emma would expect food and clothing for at least the next 18 years, if not more. And it wasn't like when Jeremy was a baby, and Faith could dress him in mismatched socks and yard sale hand-me-downs. Babies today had to coordinate. They needed BPA-free bottles and certified organic applesauce from kindly Amish farmers.
In Catherine Coulter's newest title, Split Second, an FBI thriller, a serial killer is on the loose, and it's up to FBI agents Dylan Savage and Lacey Sherlock to bring him down. They soon discover the killer has blood ties to an infamous and now long-dead monster. Savage and Sherlock are joined by agents Lucy Carlisle and Cooper McKnight, and the chase is on. At the same time, Agent Lucy Carlisle learns from her dying father that her grandfather didn't simply walk away from his family 22 years ago. He was, in fact, murdered by his wife, Lucy's grandmother. Determined to uncover the truth, Lucy moves into her grandmother's Chevy Chase mansion. Not only does she discover the truth of what happened all those years ago, but she faces a new mystery, one passed down from mother to daughter for generations. Renee Rodman and Paul Costanza narrate.
The man screamed, fell hard to his knees, clutching his shoulder, and the .22 went flying, a bullet blasting out as it left his hand. Savage listened for the Impala's engine to rev, for the car to roar out of there. But he didn't hear anything except a car door slamming shut. He yelled, "Mr. Patil, get down!" Savage dropped to the floor and was rolling when the door burst open and a submachine gun started blasting bullets. He heard Mr. Patil scream from behind the counter, knew he hadn't been fast enough, and she'd hit him. He heard the kid screaming, heard the father's deep voice, hazed over with fear, saying, "It's all right. It will be all right." He came up and fired, hit the woman square between the eyes as she swung the gun around toward him. The submachine gun hit the linoleum floor and fetched hard against the counter. Savage saw Mr. Patil leaning heavily on the counter, a bloom of red on his right arm. He jumped up and quickly checked the gunman, pulled the stocking off his face. He was white, about 40, heavy-set, his light brown hair seriously thinning. He moaned, holding his shoulder, the bullet still in him. He was lucky the bullet hadn't hit an artery. He'd survive. Savage picked up the .22 and said, "Keep pressing down on that." And then he went down on his knees beside the woman. Like the man, she was white, 40-ish. But she was dead. Her dark eyes were open. A dribble of blood came out of her mouth. And the hole between her eyes was a perfect red dot. Blood haloed her head. "Please keep their eyes covered." He quickly pulled off his leather jacket and covered the woman's face. He ran back to Mr. Patil and examined the bullet wound. "Through and through, thank God." "You did great, sir. You're going to be okay." Savage grabbed a wad of paper towels from next to the coffee machine and pressed them against Mr. Patil's arm. "Press as hard as you can, sir." He called 911 and asked for two ambulances and the police. He looked over at the father, still covering his children on the floor. Both children were quiet now, their father murmuring against their heads. "It's okay, kids. Everything's okay now." Savage looked back at the wounded man, saw he wasn't moving or making a sound. He came down on his haunches, laid his hand lightly on the man's shoulder. He was a big guy, pretty fit, his face less ashen now that he realized they'd all survived. "Don't worry, I'm FBI. You did great. You kept your kids safe. Everything's under control now. The police will be here soon. You're a very brave man. It's a pleasure to meet you." And Savage stuck out his hand. "I'm Dylan Savage." The man slowly stood, bringing the children with him, still pressed against his legs. He straightened his glasses and gave Savage a shaky grin. He started to say something, then lost the words, the wild adrenaline rush choking them off. He took Savage's hand, shook it really hard, and at last he managed to say, "I can hear my own heart beating so heavy. It's like it's going to fly out of my chest." "It's the adrenaline. Believe me, in a couple of minutes, you're going to crash." "No, I can't do that. Not with the kids here. Hey, I'm Dave Radich. Thank you for coming in like that so sharp and fast. I don't know what the guy was going to do. He might have shot all of us. It sure looked like he was going to kill Mr. Patil." "Hush, Michael. Everything's okay. Hold Chrissy's hand, okay?"
Seen a movie over the summer? She was probably in it. Turn on the tube, you'll see her everywhere. Yep, Betty White is the new It Girl right now. And in If You Ask Me, the star, who also narrates her books, delivers a hilarious, slyly profound take on love, life, celebrity, and everything in between. Drawing from a lifetime of lessons learned, 7-time Emmy winner Betty's wit and wisdom take center stage as she tackles topics that include friendship, romantic love, aging, TV, fans, love for animals, and the brave new world of celebrity. If You Ask Me mixes thoughtful observations with humorous stories from a 7-decade career in Hollywood. Longtime fans and new admirers will get a kick from Betty's candid take on everything from her rumored crush on Robert Redford to the Facebook campaign that helped persuade her to host Saturday Night Live. Featuring all new material with a focus on the past 15 years of her life, If You Ask Me is funny, sweet, and to the point, just like Betty White.
Old age isn't for sissies. I can't believe I'm getting old. Why do people ever say happy birthday? And the list goes on. We've heard them all. However, if one is lucky enough to be blessed with good health, growing older shouldn't be something to complain about. It's not a surprise. We knew it was coming. Make the most of it. So, you may not be as fast on your feet, and the image in your mirror may be a little disappointing, but if you're still functioning and not in pain, gratitude should be the name of the game. Actually, and don't laugh, there may even be some upsides to aging. People treat you more gently. They may even think your years of experience make you wiser than you are. And somebody always finds you a place to sit down, whether you want it or not. Somewhere along the line is a breaking point where you go from not discussing how old you are to bragging about it. I've never lied about my age, but these days I seem to work it into the conversation at the drop of a hat.
Readers, these best-selling women authors have covered the spectrum. You've got a lot of choices here. And speaking of choices, check out my website, bookreportradio.com, for titles everyone is talking about. You're sure to find a long list of books you'll want to read. Thanks so much for joining me today. We'll cover more of the literary landscape next week on The Book Report. Drinking now is much too late.